Now I'm recording. There we
Okay.
go.
Hello.
And welcome to Geek Brunch Retrocast.
It's the
BDTB.
retro. Hidey, hidey, ho.
So, how are you doing, Chris?
Pretty good. I'm pretty good. It's been a cold weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Not as cold as it's gonna get, but colder than it's been. It's been about 35, 40 degrees here. It's gonna warm up to the 60s next couple of days, but it's been a pretty good weekend. We celebrated my grandparents' 60th wedding anniversary last night.
Nice.
My dad's parents, yeah.
You didn't have to break the tension with the fart, did you?
No tension. I mean, I've been pooping and farting as is regular, but nothing out of the ordinary.
That's good.
No stories. Yeah, that's usually a good thing. You want the digestive system to be working properly as often as possible,
Right.
in my opinion. But you look like your new profile picture looks like you got infected with the crust.
I did, but I've put it into submission for Retrocast.
That's
I'm
cool.
saving it for Geek Brunch.
Gotcha. You're gonna save all that raping and pillaging for Bill.
Yeah, I'm gonna bend him over.
He's experienced with the crust as well, so he knows what's coming.
He's gonna get it for only eating one donut.
Yeah, that's right. You were showing him how it's done
That son of a
this weekend.
bitch. He only can eat one donut.
Yeah, I saw you guys were recording last night, and you were posting lots of good-looking food on Facebook.
Yeah.
Lots of, I think somebody said something about poop, but I know that the I know hummus
Shit on a shingle, man.
when
That's what
I
it is. That was Keith gonna eat that today, so he was posting what he's gonna eat. Daryl
it.
was posting what he was gonna eat.
Yeah, Keith likes to post a lot of pictures of food.
Yeah.
What he's eating and what he's drinking. This is episode something or other. Retrocast episode 44.
44.
We got some Buck Rogers to talk about, and we got a couple good questions today.
Yes, we
As
did.
usual, we got some comics to talk about.
We sure do.
What would you like to start with?
Let's do Buck Rogers, BD, BD, BD first,
All right,
and
let's
then go
dig
to
them
the
up.
comics.
We are very close to the end of the season. And this episode is called Buck's Duel to the Death. I took down a bunch of actors' notes this time. There weren't necessarily people that are, I would say, are big names. As usual, we had a lot of TV actors and actresses, but I had some interesting people in the episode nonetheless. And I don't know what your overall thoughts were, but I thought it was a decent episode. I thought it was pretty good.
It was a cool episode. It was very similar to the Jack Palance episode, I thought. At
Good
least had
call.
had some similarities in him fighting some guy that had powers, and he was imprisoning people and acting like a god. In this case, he was acting more like a dictator.
Yeah.
And he was an asshole because he would let these guys fight, but then he would use his powers at the end. He'd be like, I'm unarmed, I'm tough.
Yeah, the guy you're talking about, he was known as the Trabor.
Think that's a
And
title, though, right? Because it said there
yeah.
were like many Trabors before him.
Yeah, I don't think they ever called him other anything other than that, though, did they? I didn't catch it if they
No,
did.
I think that was his, what they called him.
But he was played by a guy named William Smith, who probably the most interesting of the guest stars. He was the
Was
final ever Marlboro Man.
Oh, really?
For television, Marlboro Man. You know, at a certain point, they banned cigarette advertisements, commercials on TV. But he was the final Marlboro Man on the TV commercials. He served in Korean War in the Korean War, and then he's just been in a ton of different cult films. People most prominently might know him from being in the Arnold Schwarzenegger court Conan the O'Brien Conan the
Conan He's on TNT every week.
Nice.
Or TBS, very funny.
Conan, the Conan movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Conan the O'Brien.
I'd like to see that. I'm sure somebody's done something with that. And the another one I wrote down was the Clint Eastwood movie, Any Which Way You Can.
Yeah, he looks so familiar, but I'm looking at his thing as we speak, and man, I can't. Except he was in The Outsiders. Maybe that's what I saw him in recently.
He's been in a lot of stuff. But he plays a lot of heavies and villains because he's got kind of a beat up looking face, and
I'm sure he thanks you for that.
he just looks like a real weathered dude. You know, like he just looks like a tough guy. And but I was interested to find out that he's actually fluent in Russian, French, Serbo-Croatian, and German, and he actually taught Russian at UCLA for a while. So looks are deceiving in the case of this guy, and or at least a lot of the roles that he played weren't quite the person he was in real life. But yeah, the Trebor, he's been pretty much oppressing this planet called Katar, and there are two daughters of the prime minister of Katar, a man named Darius. His daughter's names are Maya and Vion, and Maya is abducted at the beginning of the episode by the Trebor. And the Trebor, this is in the long line of him having abducted many beautiful women from Katar to be his wives. And so they're distressed, and they have this myth on their planet. Darius and some of his advisors are discussing what to do about the Trebor now that he's actually abducted one of the prime minister's daughters. And this myth is that there's going to be a man called the Roshan, who's a 500-year-old man that will come and deliver them from their oppression. And one of Darius's advisors tells him, you know, they know about Buck Rogers and how he's actually from 500 years in the past. So even if they don't believe in the myth, the people of their planet do, and technically Buck Rogers fits the criteria, so they want to bring Buck Rogers to their planet to stand up to the Trebor, or at least at least make a symbol out of him to give the people of the planet hope.
Right, if he is a rumor, then at least put the rumor in front of him and give them hope. But he's a, this guy, this Trebor guy, he just like goes to take the women that he wants, and he has like a harem. So he could have sex with all these different women, and he just takes daughters. And then the men he'll take to a display in like gladiator battles, which he'll take some of the guards that he wants and then fight with them, and he toys with them. He lets them have like a sword, and he uses his karate chops, and then eventually electrocutes them to death, because they said he has the power to of 3 times the lethal dosage of electricity that the body can take. So he could shock the hell out of them.
Yeah, that's the other main thing that he's doing is He's stealing the women, but then he's going through and killing a lot of their strong men, because once a month he duels a man to the death, and he at this point has killed off a lot of their most strong and powerful men. So it's kind
They
of
li they li
decimating.
they live in fear. It's kind of like a dragon. I forget what that movie was, Dragonlance or whatever the fuck the movie was, where they'd have to have a dowry and they would go give their virgin to the dragon. Well, this time they give it to the Trabor.
Was it Dragon
Dragon
Slayer?
Slayer, yeah.
Yeah. Dragonlance, that's Keith's, that's what Keith and Chris were
That's
talking
the
about.
yeah, that's the
D&D.
midget vampires and lady friends.
That's Forgotten Realms, Mike.
Oh, okay, I'm
Come
sorry.
on. Drist is Forgotten Realms. And Dragonlance is something else.
I
It's a
can't get
different
that shit in
world.
my head. It's fantasy. You gotta
You're
roll
like,
the dice. I don't know how to roll the dice.
get that out of my head. I need space for more comic book knowledge. But yeah, so Buck and Wilmer are on, I guess, a routine flight or mission or something like that, and they come across a man, they come across a ship that's in distress, that's being attacked by others. So they save him. It's a man named Neil, who's played by an actor named Edward Power. They bring him back to Earth. Neil's one of he works for the Prime Minister Darius, and he invites them in gratitude to their seemingly in gratitude to them saving him. He invites them to come back and be guests of the Katarian people and visit their planet. Wilma says that she's busy right now because the script wants to separate them out once again. But Buck's like, sure, I'll go, and then Twiggy pretty much invites himself along, and Buck yells at him for having bad manners. But Neil's okay with Twiggy coming with him.
I wish they wouldn't write out Wilma as much as they do in these last few
Yeah.
episodes, because
Yeah, she pretty much always has the subplot.
it's very similar. It's like she'll be at the beginning saying, "Well, I have stuff to do, I can't go," and then she maybe will show up at the end, and that's it.
Yeah,
Sometimes
it's
she'll go undercover and go
right.
rescue Buck or try to.
But yeah, regardless of what she does, it's always she kind of does the support role in the subplot. It has become a little formulaic where no matter what she does, it's always kind of something in support of the main plot. And it's okay for a number of issues back. It would have been a good idea for them to change it up for an episode or here or there. Just so the pattern doesn't become so obvious. But so yeah, Buck goes back with them. Soon finds out that taken before Darius, and I don't think I mentioned it earlier, he's played by a guy named Keith Andes, and this is I found it interesting that this was pretty much he seems pretty energetic and everything in the episode, but and he did live for a lot longer, but he retired from acting pretty much after one more project. But he had been acting for a really long time at this point and was kind of a perpetual second lead. He'd be in a lot of movies where he'd be the there'd be a main actor and he'd be the second most prominent actor in the film. But I liked him. I thought he portrayed the Darius or Darius as the as a pretty
Good leader.
heroic leader and father. As you kind of see throughout the rest of the episode.
But is he really heroic? Because he seemed to look for solutions after his daughter was taken.
True.
In other words, it's been happening for a long time. And
That's true.
now he's like, "Oh, it's my daughter that's in jeopardy, so maybe I need to do something about it."
That's true. On the flip side, I'd say he shows a lot of loyalty to Buck, later on, he's not
Yeah,
willing to be fucked behind.
you're
And
right. In the episode, he is like
in the episode itself.
a hero.
But
And
that's a good point,
he
yeah.
does save his ass a couple times. And he never gets captured.
True.
Like the other guys.
Yeah. So Buck's a little, he's a little hesitant, but conveniently, the room that he stays in that they give him is right next door to the Darius's other daughter, Vion. And he hears her crying and walks over to his room and, of course, comforts her and finds out, this is where he actually finds out about Maya, that it's that it the most recent woman to be abducted is Vion's sister, and Buck can't resist a woman in distress. So, she flatters him. She says, "You're so different from the men I've known."
Yeah, she flatters him a couple of times, and one time she's like I would like to talk about you and let you know how wonderful you are. And he's like, "Well, tell me, baby," or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like, "Yeah, let me have
Yeah,
it."
he says like well, he's like, "Don't let me stop you."
Don't let me stop you.
Yeah. But so he's pretty much convinced at this point. And meanwhile, as you mentioned before, there's really kind of an interesting comedic scene where Wilma goes to see, she's looking for a guy named Dr. Junius, but she finds a man named Dr. Albert, who I guess he's kind of really interested in old technology because he's surrounded by it. And when she gets there, she can't find anybody, and all of a sudden he comes out of this old school stagecoach that he's got in the room,
This
and he's
was
holding a hairdryer.
that was a cool scene. I really
It
dug
was
that
funny,
scene.
yeah.
Because he didn't he was so preoccupied with he was like a guy working at like a antique shop. But he's like so infatuated with everything that he's doing and the old technology that he didn't even want to pay attention. I don't even think he looked up to see Wilma was hot. He was too busy looking at the blow dryer.
Right.
And then the scene ends and he's like he has those little balls that you like you push on a string and they like knock each other where they go tick 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 tick.
Yeah, back and forth, people have on their desks.
Yeah. He just sits there and starts looking at it like,
Yeah,
wow,
he's
this is
fascinated by it.
awesome.
Yeah, and he thinks that the hair dryer that he's holding is some sort of old 20th century laser rifle. So yeah, he's pretty distracted throughout the whole scene and kind of a comedic relief, I guess. But this is Wilma, where Wilma finds out the information that Dr. Junius left for her, tells her that Trebor has had electrical circuitry implanted under his skin, and he can hurl electricity, like electrical bolts, at people. And while this is going on, Buck and Darius formulate a plan to actually take the fight to the Trebor. They decide to infiltrate his place, and this is the first time, I guess, like Buck's presence is infusing a lot of bravery into the Katarian men that remain. So they head to Trebor's place. I thought it was kind of funny that Darius seems to know exactly where the emergency access to the women's quarters is. I assume he was supposed to have maybe looked at blueprints or something like that, but it's kind of funny the way he presents it. He just happens to know where that is and that there is an emergency access that you can just crawl into. But
And did the Trebor, he actually had like the sexy woman that was with him all the time. Like, I don't know
yes,
if her name was Greta or
it was
Stephanie Blackmore, and she was like hot as shit, but
exactly.
I guess she wasn't good enough for him because she was loyal and sexy, but he had to have all these other sexy women doing his nails and feeding him grapes and having
That was the
sex with
funny
them.
thing. Yeah, that was the funny thing about the casting was that I thought that she was the most beautiful woman in the episode.
Yeah, she was. I agree.
Stephanie Blackmore, but but yeah, compared to Maya and Vion and like the extras that when they do rescue the women from the trade war, including Maya, there's seven of them that come climbing out of the emergency access after, when Buck leads them out. But yeah, as you said, Stephanie Blackmore, I guess it seems like the thing that she's most known for being is she had a reoccurring role on Dallas, named playing a character named Serena Wald. I didn't watch Dallas, so I
So
wasn't one.
either did I. She
But
was very loyal to him though. Like even though she knew she was aware of what he was doing, and she didn't seem like she was doing it out of imprisonment, you know what I mean? Like she wasn't like doing it, she was doing it more 'cause whatever she thought he was, she was loyal to him. Like he was a dictator and he had the right to be the dictator. He had the right to take all these women.
Yeah, she didn't really have any, there wasn't like a character arc for her or anything. I mean, she's pretty much, his assistant, or she almost like had a like a vice, like a number one, like she was his number one,
Yeah.
More so than anything else. But it turns out that that there's actually one of the advisors of Darius is a traitor, a man named Kellen. And he eventually gets through. He has trouble for a while trying to make a transmission because there's like interference. But when he eventually does, when he does actually get through, he tells Trebor's men that Buck and Darius and the other Katarians are on the ship. So there's two groups of the infiltration. There's Darius and Buck go for the women, and then the guy Neil, who had earlier visited Earth, he leads a group of soldiers to actually attack and assassinate the Trebor, and they're unsuccessful. They're taken out pretty easily because just as they arrive to where the Trebor is, as you said, lounging with some ladies, the Trebor's men that talk to Kellen rush over there just in time to keep them from taking out the Trebor. Pretty much like all the soldiers are killed, and Neil makes it away. Neil escapes. I don't know if the other soldiers are killed, but because Buck goes back for them and sends the women off on the ship. And this is where we're.
There's one scene that I want to point out that I thought was pretty funny, and it's when Buck is with Darius. Darius is the bald guy, right?
The
The
Prime
leader,
Minister.
prime minister. There's a scene there where there's a bunch of guards and they're like playing some kind of like gambling game or dice game or something like that, and they're like wrapped around a circle and they're playing, and they like take them out like one by one by one. It's like they'll make a noise or something, and then one guard goes to check it out. They knock him out, and then they'll do it again, and then another guard goes until they have like two guards left.
All
Like,
because
damn.
they wanted to make a joke.
Yeah.
Because they go, "You guys just rolled snake eyes," and there's two left, and take them out. Yeah, that was funny.
Thought that was hilarious. And I could have sworn though that some of those scenes where Buck was doing the fighting, he actually looked like Buck. Like he actually threw the punches and stuff. And it's the first time I've seen that.
This should maybe be the highest rated episode then.
Yeah, he actually didn't look like he was 5 feet shorter or
They in their endless search for a Gil Gerard double, they finally found one that actually was the same size. So yeah, this is where we were saying that Darius shows some heroism because he's not going to leave Buck alone. So he follows after Buck, and it turns out to be a good thing, because Buck Buck gets apprehended. Darius is able to free him. And I thought that Darius was going to get captured too. So that was a nice little surprise for me to see that they actually are successful. Darius and Buck steal one of the Trebor's ship to make it back and make it back to Katar, where they find Twiki hanging out with the women that they rescued. And they immediately arrest Kellen for being a traitor. He like does a immediate turn as soon as they accuse him. He puts up no protest and yells, "You can't resist the Trebor!" as they carry him away. But the plot continues because they know, even though they got away, that the Trebor will be coming after them.
And he
So,
does. He basically gets in a ship with several other men and goes after Buck for a final showdown. And they have like that at the first, like at Star Wars, where you have all the rebels lined up against in the spaceship. You have that kind of happen in a warehouse here. You have all those troopers lined up to protect Buck, and then you have all the other guys raiding in to come fight and have this laser fight. And then the Trebor is like, we don't need to spill blood. Let's just fight mano a mano. And it's pretty cool because through Wilma's, telling them what's how the Trebor has powers and stuff, they're able to device a Twiggy that they rig Twiggy to be able to absorb that electricity and shoot it back. They turn him into a huge transformer, an electrical transformer, not a real transformer. And they have this cool fight scene, which I really dig. It came to a cool conclusion.
Yeah, it
And they
was a
had a
nice
good
little showdown.
laser they had a cool laser fight too. Like, you don't see too much of that, where Buck tried to, he actually shot a guard because he saw him coming across, and it started like a little laser fight. And b before the Trebor says, "Stop shooting, let's fight this thing out." And then Buck's like, why should we fight? If you're armed." He says, "I'm unarmed." Bullshit.
Yeah, 'cause he before this all happens, he gets to talk to Doc Huer and Wilma briefly over video chat over Skype and they tell him the deal about Trebor's electrical abilities and stuff, and I mean he's seen evidence of it, but they let him know how he's doing it. I loved that. Loved Buck's battle outfit because
Yeah, it didn't
he
look like a
changes at
battle
this point.
outfit.
Yeah, he's wearing like super tight white pants and look basically what looks like a like an 80s white suit jacket
Yeah,
over without a shirt underneath
looks
it.
like he's going dancing. He actually wore an outfit that looked a lot like a comic book I'm going to be talking about called Cobalt.
Nice. It was before his time. Or after he's before his time, but after his time. I also liked that before Trebor even shows up, Twiggy tries to make a run for it. Tries to escape. And when Trebor sees Twiggy standing there with Buck, he says, "What is that?" and Buck answers, "It's a little 20th century ingenuity in basic electronics." And when he takes him out later, he says, "You should have paid your light bill." But
The ending was great. I thought it was awesome.
yeah, I've been posting pictures of it.
Yeah, it's your Skype
Yeah, I
picture
just
now.
changed it. I saw that you changed yours, so I was like, "Oh, I gotta keep up." But yeah, Twinkie shows up now that he's gone through the battle successfully. He's all brave, and he shows up with a cowboy hat on and six shooters at the end. They always got to have that joke at the end of the episode. Finish it off that way.
Yeah, he's like Beady, beady, beady. It's like a showdown at the OK Corral, and he's like, "I want all the horses, I want
Yeah.
all the women, I want all the money, I want everything." And Buck's like, "Okay, then we're gonna have to fight." And he says, "Well, you can keep the horses."
You could keep the horses. That'd be a good pod. That'd be a good episode name.
You can keep the horses.
Yeah.
But it was cool in that one scene, like you were saying, where they went to that one guy who was the archivist. All the cool shit that they had in there. You know what I mean? Like, Buck would have loved that, like, to go into that.
True. True. Yeah, and we also had our regular 20th century colloquialism that Buck says, and Wilmer or Dr. Hewer is confused by, because before they rescue Neil, he tells her the last one's a rotten egg. She's like, a rotten egg? She doesn't even seem to know what an egg is, so.
All they eat is like those pills.
That's true. Yeah, they
Remember?
don't probably don't have
It's
any eggs.
all like synthesized proteins that they eat. Unless Buck
Yeah.
like turns them onto a hamburger made out of some kind of lizard. But yeah, that was a good episode. We're on to our last one actually of season one.
Yeah, next time we have a our first two-parter for in a while.
Yeah,
I've
it's
really
got
had.
some interesting people in it. It's got Julie Newmar, Pamela Hensley, which is Ardala, and Kane is back. I'm not sure if it's the
Yes.
same. Oh, Sid Haig. I'm a huge Sid Haig fan, so. And I've heard of Vera Miles. I just don't remember who that is.
Yeah, there's I forgot what I was gonna say.
Psycho 2, that's what I know her from.
Yeah.
She was in the Psycho movies.
Oh, okay. Awesome. So yeah, I liked it. I thought it was a pretty decent episode.
Right.
So it was up there.
So you want to do some questions since we got some?
Sure. Got some good ones. A couple good ones. I saw.
Donnie Salvo says, "What is your favorite era team of Avengers?"
Yeah, and I went with one that I'm nostalgic for. I've talked before about how where I started reading the Avengers, and that was with the Under Siege storyline, and so I like that lineup, but a little bit more little modified version of that from a few years later. I don't think that this is really ever in any top list of Avengers lineups or anything like that, but when I really started buying comics for my own and going to the store and stuff, was later on when John Byrne did a short run and then Fabian Nicieza took over as writer. And at that time, it was kind of a strange lineup, and I sort of have a just an affection for him via nostalgia, where it was Captain America, Quasar was on the team, the Thor, and the white version of the Vision, and the Eternal Circe were the main core of the five that were on the team, and they had like the Crossing Lines storyline, and there was like a cool Iron Man would show up occasionally, and Star Fox helped out a little bit, but there was a cool like 3-issue storyline with where Spider-Man guest starred, where they went up against Nebula, but yeah, so that was I kind of have a soft spot for that one. That one's like a sort of a different one that people don't talk about too much.
Yeah, definitely. I think mine is the simpler team where it had Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, Captain America, and Goliath. That was my favorite team. It was only like a four roster, but there were the 12-cent issues. And I didn't buy the 12-cent issues off of the stand, but I traded for them because one of the guys I traded with, his dad had a bunch of Silver Age comics, and I really like that team because you have two guys that are kind of normal for the most part, and then two mutants. But Not only were they have interesting stories, but they seemed like not to be the most powerful Avengers, but the most interesting, because you had Cap, and then you had three people that were evil. Like Hawkeye started off as a bad seed, and the two mutants were, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. They were Magneto's kids. So yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. It's like you got one guy that's trying to rehabilitate three villains to turn them into the Avengers. Oh, and then you had Goliath. He was still good. He was one of the originals. He was the only original Avenger at the time.
And that was definitely at the time of quite a change, I would say.
Yeah.
So the next question, Jim Dietz. I did some research for this one to make up for the fact that I felt like I haven't read a lot of stuff that would apply to the question. That question is, what our favorite DC, like DC's Kirby, Kirby's DC properties, what's our favorite version of one of those by a different writer or artist, to come after he did all his DC stuff. So I actually went through and jotted down some of those to go through them. If you want to talk about them, and then could say whatever our favorites were. But I didn't write down every appearance, but some of the more prominent actual series and stuff. Going back when DC or when he worked for DC earlier on, he co-created the Challengers of the Unknown. And there was a series in 1991 by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. Any of these, if you want to comment, if that you've read them, because a lot of them I haven't.
I have read the Challengers. It was really, really good. I
Cool.
remember reading it, and that was my first exposure to the Challengers, is what you're talking about now.
Nice. And then more recently, a couple years ago, there was, I think it was three issues, but there was a storyline in DC Universe Presents, with like a New 52 Challenges the Unknown that Dan DiDio did with Jeff Ordway art.
That was really good.
That I did read.
I'm a big fan of Dan DiDio's stuff. I find it has like a very Bronze Age feel, and maybe that's why a lot of people don't dig it, but there's a Bronze Age feel to all that stuff to me.
I mean, I haven't read some of the stuff they did towards the end of prior to the New 52 relaunch, but I do like the stuff that he's done that's on different Kirby properties like this. So then getting into all the stuff that he did in the 70s, the New Gods. Of course, they've appeared a lot of different places, but as far as an actual series, there was the New Gods series that started in 1989 that followed the Cosmic Odyssey miniseries. That was actually written by Kirby protege Mark Evanier and head art by Paris Collins, and that lasted for 28 issues. And then later on, there was another volume in 1995 of the New Gods that those started off being written by Tom Payer and Rachel Pollack with Luke Ross art. Later on, John Byrne did some issues, and that was followed up with an Orion series by Walter Simonson. But yeah, more recently, you had your Death in the New Gods series, and they were really prominently used in Grant Morrison's Final Crisis that I have read. And I also, go ahead.
I have read all of these.
Yeah, I figured.
Yeah.
And more recently, going on right now actually is they're being New 52 New Gods are heavily involved in a Green Lantern family crossover called Godhead.
And Ryan was involved in Wonder Woman quite a bit
Yes, yeah.
as a supporting cast member. And
So you have.
one of them I'd like to point out is the Orion series by Walt Simonson. That is being the reason I want to point it out is because they're turning it into an omnibus, kind of like the
Oh,
Fourth
nice.
World omnibuses, and it's solicited in this month's previews, and I'm definitely going to buy it.
Oh,
I
cool.
it is the one series I haven't read the entire storyline. Like I've read I think the first six or maybe first 10, but I haven't read the entire series, and that one ran 25 issues, so a good portion of it will be new to me.
Nice. Yeah, I might have to check that out. But I definitely would
He
like to
wrote
check
it
that out
and
at some point.
drew it.
Yeah, nice. So you also had Mr. Miracle. He, of course, was part of the Justice League revamp post-crisis, given DeMatteis. And because of that, DeMatteis ended up writing a started at least was the first writer for a 19, series that started in 1989 that lasted for 28 issues. Keith Giffen, Len Wein, and Doug Munch also wrote some issues in that run. There was also a 7-issue Mr. Miracle series in 1996, written by Kevin Dooley. And then Mr. Miracle also was a Shiloh Norman version of Mr. Miracle was in Grant Morrison's Seven Soldiers. And there's been a Mr. Miracle involved a lot in the Earth 2, New 52 Earth 2 series.
Did you mention the first series though that Englehart took over on issue 19 from Kirby, volume one?
No, I didn't mention that kept going.
Yeah,
Yeah, you're right.
19 through 25 kept going, and you had some interesting writers in there. You had Steve Englehart with artist Marshall Rogers, who's a very famous artist. At least he drew like the Laughing Fish, which is a big detective comic storyline with the Joker. And you have Steve Gerber and Michael Golden on the last few. So
Yeah,
you got a
recall.
good creative teams taking over that.
Yeah, definitely. So Forever People, there was a 6-issue miniseries in 1988 by again DeMatteis with art by Paris Collins. Right now there is a new 52 series called Infinity Man and the Forever People, by Dan DiDio and a bunch of different artists. I thought it was going to be like more consistently Keith Giffen, like the OMAC that they did, but it's been a lot of different people. And speaking of OMAC, your favorite,
Yes, many incarnations of that.
I did not know. So yeah, as you said, I mean, I did not know about a 4-issue miniseries by John Byrne in 1991.
Yeah, it's black and white.
Yeah, I did not even know that existed until I did this research, so I'm
Delu
happy to
del
find that out.
deluxe cover too. Like
Yeah.
it was a prestige format where they costed like $4 each.
When I was looking it up, actually, I saw you can get them for like less than $2 a piece, probably. So I might check those out.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's all awesome stuff.
Yeah, I saw like mycomicshop.com had them for like a dollar something a piece. So, and yeah, as you kind of alluded to, I think, not the like singular Buddy Blank-ish kind of one person OMAC, but the OMAC technology was used really extensively around the time of the Infinite Crisis crossover. And then
Called the OMAC Project by
right.
Greg Rucka and Jesus Seiss.
Yeah.
That was when they started to assimilate people.
Right.
And Batman put the satellite up there to control things, and it got out of control.
Yeah, Batman kind of got pulled into the story at that point. With the New 52 relaunch, there was an Olmec series that sadly only lasted 8 issues, by Dan DiDio and Keith Giffen, doing a very Kirby-esque style art. And then, since then, especially in the Futures and Weekly series, Olmec has been used kind of in a more of the way that it was in the Infinite Crisis, although the art of the Olmecs reflects more of like the style that was come up for the Olmec New 52 series, I would say.
And just, and then just to why are you going to get to Commandy?
I was going to mention with Commandy, he's appeared a bunch of different places.
Yeah.
Though, as far as like a series, there wasn't a lot of his own series. I mean, he did continue, like, as you said, with Mr. Miracle. I should mention that Commandy was the series that lasted the longest after Kirby left DC.
Which is the one that's kind of, it interests me most from a historical standpoint, just because of what it was at the time it was. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was post-apocalyptic with a with a guy with shorts.
Yeah.
so like, what really interests me is like, what would appeal to a kid at that time, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it was post-apocalyptic, but you look at
the creatures main character, stuff,
you might think
yeah.
it's like a Tarzan series or something.
True.
But yeah, when DC did a thing called Wednesday Comics, there was a Commandy strip in that by Dave Gibbons and Ryan Sook. That was pretty critically acclaimed. I think a lot of people are still hoping to see more of that interpretation by Ryan Sook and stuff. And the final property I made note of was the Demon. The Demon and the Demon Etrigan and Jason Blood, been used really extensively in a lot of different places, by different creators and stuff. As far as an actual additional series, I only just made note of the Demon Knights, which was another New 52 series, which involved a team where the Demon Etrigan was part of that team. When that launched, it was by Paul Cornell and Diogenes Nieves. Later on, it lasted 23 issues, and later on it was written by Robert Venditti, and there's a few different artists, but Bernard Chang did a bunch.
And he does play a lot into the mystical books like Phantom Stranger and Pandora and all that stuff.
Yeah.
He shows up a lot in Batman because he's a demonologist, and he's showed up at Detective and Batman a lot.
Yep. Yeah, so he's been a prominent character. Definitely was a significant contribution to DC's like mystical, magical side.
And then you got the Demon, the second series, written by Matt Wagner. So you Grendel fans.
Oh right.
He did in 1987. He did a 4-issue miniseries, and then there was a big run in 1990. Which started off with Zero Year, or at least it integrated itself with Zero Year, like 4 years later. It started in 1990. Zero Year was 1994. But that run had this was my favorite Demon run. Even more so than the Kirby stuff. And I think it was just because of what was happening in Hell. They like took it, a lot of it, to actual Hell. And it was Garth Ennis and did a lot of it. Alan Grant started it. And I think if I go back to like the 80s and the early 90s, Alan Grant was my favorite writer. He was the man. I mean, with what he did with Rebels and Legion, you know, the Legion 89 and the Legion 90s and Lobo, and just the stuff that he wrote in Detective Comics and with Breyfogle. I thought his stuff, like when I was reading that stuff at the comic stores and stuff. I think this was the comic store era where I was getting stuff at the comic store. His writing just really clicked with me, no matter what he did. So yeah, I'm an Alan Grant fan.
Yeah, nice. Thanks for those additions, because I'm surprised I forgot the Demon the Matt Wagner series, because I've seen that around. And so that's a bit of a breakdown. I thought it'd be interesting to actually kind of, because it got me thinking the question about all of it. And I'm very curious, especially after we read the New Gods series for this podcast. I've had in the back of my mind to, I've read the more recent stuff, but a lot of the stuff that came in the 80s and stuff I haven't, and would like to see those interpretations of these characters that we've talked about a lot. So.
Let's not forget Clarion the Witch Boy, who had a 4-issue miniseries off of Seven Soldiers and also has his new ongoing. So
True. Very good. Yeah,
there's another one created out of the demon, the Book of the Demon that spawned his own. And then we can't forget the Guardian, who
True.
also had his series 4-issue off of the Seven Soldiers, and plus the Guardian shows up a lot in the Superman books as like a supporting cast, especially like a lot in the Jerry Ordway era of Superman. That you had a lot of the Guardian there, and a lot of Project Cadmus, which may be a Kirby creation. I don't. I'd
Hello.
have to go look. Are you there?
Yeah, I lost you for a little bit there, but you were saying
Oh, I
take
was
it
just.
from
Project Cadmus, did you hear me?
Jerry Ordway.
Oh
Jerry
yeah.
Ordway, Guardian, and scene.
I was just saying Project Cadmus. I don't know if he created that, but it did show up in a lot of books and stuff, and all
I
those
think so.
characters.
I think he did.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, I figured, okay, I'm gonna take some notes down here, and then so I can contribute to this question, and then Mike will fill in from his brain anything I forget.
There's probably a lot of others too, but those are the one. You got the main stuff.
Yeah, that's why I figured. I just try to get the main stuff. I mean, and I'm gonna say because I haven't read any of the 80s or 90s stuff that I've talked about or that we just talked about. For me, I would actually probably go with the New 52 OMAC series. I thought those 8 issues were really fun. Changed things up enough to make it a different interpretation, but also is really faithful, enjoyable to somebody if you liked the original OMAC series. Even though I wish it lasted longer, the 8 issues that we got form a really nice story.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I'm a huge OMAC fan, so that series I've actually liked all the OMAC series, and there have been five of them. So a couple of them involved the satellite. You had the John Byrne one, but this one is the New 52 OMAC is probably my favorite of all the different incarnations. And I did want to point out. There's another Challengers of the Unknown series in 1997 to 1998 by Len Kaminski and Stephen Grant. That was a series that I didn't buy, which I'm pretty shocked.
Me
I
too.
am going to have to buy that. And then the third series was by Howard Chaykin. Let's not forget that in 2004, 2006.
All right, yeah.
And
Good
then
call.
you covered the other one, which was the mini.
Yeah. I did like Demon Knights a lot though. That was a really good series of some of the newer stuff, and so far the first four parts I've read. I think a couple more have come out, or maybe just one more, but Godhead, the Godhead story is cool, and it's got a lot of different artists on it, but as far as the writing goes, I mean, I think it's pretty neat. It's definitely a different take on the High Father, and I think it's kind of an interesting one. So I'm liking that, but I'll go with the OMAC 2011
Me
series.
too. All of these I've liked, but that one's by far my favorite.
And Mr. Miracle, I haven't read the actual series, but I've read a lot of him as written by Giffen and DeMatteis in the JLI, and I like their treatment of him and Big Barda and what's his face, the little guy,
Oberon.
Oberon. So those are the honorable mentions, I guess.
And then Justice League, they played a good part in Justice League International too, those three. Even
Yeah.
Oberon had more of he was kind of like one of the main guys that would talk to Maxwell Lord and stuff, you know, to run things.
Yeah, they did. They made good use of him.
Art-wise,
So.
it's still Giffen that I think captures the Kirby art, but the other artist I would like to mention that's done on these books that I hold a special place is Paris Collins. He drew some of the New Gods and the Forever People 1988 series, the one done by DeMatteis, and
Right.
I just dug his art. Like when you say Paris Collins, I think of the New Gods and I think of Blue Beetle and Blue Devil. Those are the ones I think of, but all of which properties that I have a real fondness for. But there were
Nice.
good questions, and we have one other that I don't think you have seen
I don't. I have
because
not.
it
No.
came in my mail.
Oh, okay.
So let me get to that real quick.
All right. This will be off the cuff. I can't have prepared for this one.
You can't have prepared. All right, so this is from our friend Brian Regate from Comics and History.
Nice.
And which I want to say that I have been always in my how could you say it, in my like protective zone of listening to the same podcasts probably for the last, I don't know, 6 years, where it became routine and I didn't usually explore outside of the podcast that I would listen to.
Because you don't have a lot of time to listen to it, though, should be said.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the other thing. I used to have commutes to work. Now my commute to work is 5 minutes. So,
Yeah.
most of my podcast listening is when I'm doing the dishes, shopping at Target, or walking the dog. And I love comics and history. And I'm not just saying this to kiss Brian's ass. I really, it's a podcast that makes me happy. And I don't, other podcasts, they'll say something negative or something, and it just makes me like raise my fist in the air as I hear it. And I'm like, son of a bitch. And like Brian's positivity, I really like. And plus, I love the work that he puts into it. Like he puts a lot of research into it, and he's very concise in the time that he's given. Like his episodes will range anywhere from 30 minutes to 45 minutes, and then you're done, which is probably almost one Harley walk. But it's also good in the time that it's allocated because I can fit them in the morning.
Yeah.
The bad news is I'm caught up. I have one more episode to listen to in Elseworlds, and then I've listened to every one of them. So then I have to wait every Monday. But having said that, I really enjoyed his Guy Gardner coverage like a lot. I enjoyed 0 Hour again. It made me want to revisit it. And I liked his comics through the decade because he had a very interesting perspective, and it's a perspective that is not given too often, is love for the 90s. And it sounds like he got a really good appreciation for comic books in the 90s. And then he went back and forward. But yeah, I love that podcast, and he sent us a listener question. He said, da 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 da, are there any past comics or sci-fi actors, past comic or sci-fi actors who would you'd like to meet, like past actors that were in comic books or sci-fi that you'd like to meet?
Interesting.
I can answer that now. I would really like to meet I can't name his name anymore, but Barb will tell me his name once I say it. It's the guy from Spartacus and Deathstroke from Arrow. Yeah, what's his name?
Oh,
The
Crixus.
actor.
Manu
Mono Bennett. See, I knew she'd get it.
Oh,
But
okay.
I'd like to meet him just because
Nice.
I have really got hooked with season two of Arrow. Like it hooked me in season one, but watching it in the order that I watched it in season two, man, that was like a hell of a build up. Because the whole season was Deathstroke centric. And the flashbacks were all awesome. I would like to meet him. I would like to meet Gil Gerard now that we've done this Buck Rogers. I've already met Erin Gray, so I've achieved that. I've met Lou Ferrigno, so had the Hulk love. I guess Nicholas Hammond, if he's still alive, that would be kind of cool. The guy who played Amazing Spider-Man in the TV show.
Oh, okay. Nice. That's a good question. I think that one of the first persons I thought of actually was Michael Keaton. I think he's on my mind because I want to see that new movie that he's in.
Birdman.
Yeah, but I always thought he seemed like an interesting, kind of a cool guy.
Yeah.
I don't know what it would be like to meet him, but
Plus he's the best Batman, let's be honest.
I do. Well, he was the first one I really associated with Batman because I loved the first two movies when I was younger, but I didn't read a lot of comics, so he was kind of the first Batman for me, really.
Christopher Reeve, if he was still alive, would be cool.
Oh man, good call.
Yeah.
That guy was so awesome, you know.
Harrison Ford would be awesome. I think. But he as he gets older, he seems a little bit different, but
I don't know if I'd almost want to just watch from a distance as he acts like a jerk to people because I think he's kind of hilarious as like a cantankerous old dude.
yeah.
But what was he in that was sci-fi? No, just kidding.
Indiana Jones and Han Solo.
Just kidding.
American Graffiti. Matter of fact, when he came out as Han Solo, of all the characters that were in the Star Wars, I like latched on to him. I said, "That's my guy." Like, I didn't care about the Force. I cared about this badass who was awesome with the pistol and had a Wookiee. And can fly the Millennium Falcon and stole shit. That was my guy. And when they froze him in carbonite, it just literally killed me.
I did like Han Solo a lot too, when I was a kid. One other that came to mind for a totally different reason was Anna Torv, who was in Fringe, which is sci-fi, so it counts.
Yeah.
But the only reason that's just because she's like probably top five for me as far as actresses I'm attracted to. But actually, from that show, a really cool actor was Lance Riddick, who was also in The Wire and Lost. He seems like a cool guy. I'm just falling down a Oh, then he's actually the voice of Ra's al Ghul in Beware the Batman, which I have never watched. And he was an American Horror Story. I'm just falling down an IMDb quicksand hole here. So, yeah, thanks for the question, Brian. And I echo the things Mike said about comics and history. I listened to it first, just to just kidding. But no,
He
the
no,
series you
he's
mentioned, the
honest.
Zero.
You did listen to it first. I was hesitant to get to it just because I had, like I said, I was in my comfort zone.
Right. No,
And
I mean, I'm not kidding that it was.
then it was a build up of one podcast that I listened to just making me feel bad for liking what I like. And I was loyal listener. I mean, loyal, like I listened to it over and over again, and it was a buildup of me just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
And I left it, and that was a long ass podcast, so that freed up 2.5 hours.
Yeah. yeah, I was just it's true that I did listen to it first, but I was just kidding as it if about the idea of that mattering. But because I do have a lot more time to listen to podcasts. I have a long commute, and I also can it's a little easier for me to still concentrate while I'm working and listen to podcasts some of the time. So I have more time to listen to shows and get
And
through a
you
lot more.
have you're not as single threaded as me.
I don't know if that's true as if, but
I tried the other day, like to listen to a podcast as I was doing stuff, and I might have heard 2 words because my brain was concentrating on this problem, and I couldn't hear anything. But I could listen to music because you don't have to concentrate on music.
Right. And I do listen to music as well when I know that if I listen to a podcast, like you just said, I'll miss most of it anyways, depending on the level of my concentration at the time. So
Dress up for
anyway.
Halloween
Yeah, I was Twiggy the one day,
and the Godzilla the other
and
day.
then I was Godzilla, yeah. Not really. That
Didn't have
Godzilla was
any
like my.
like parties to go to where you had to dress up as a Teletubby or something?
No, unfortunately, no. I just had to steal Chinese food in my own regular clothes instead of a Teletubby. But no, and we were talking about how we kind of it'd be kind of fun to know somebody that had a cool Halloween party or something to go to because it'd be fun to dress up. But I haven't dressed up in a long time.
All
But
righty.
I think it was Jimmy Palmiotti on Twitter or somebody said Happy National Cosplay Day, which I liked that.
Yeah.
So. If you cosplayed, what would you cosplay as? That's my
OMAC.
question. Nice.
But I'd want to lose some weight first. Be
Oh.
like this fat ass OMAC.
Well, an OMAC assimilates anybody, you
I'll
know,
say.
big or small.
Omactivate.
Yes. I think I've always thought it would be really cool to come up with a Dr. Midnight costume. Like
Nice.
the JSA Dr. Midnight.
Yeah.
Someday I haven't totally discarded the idea of doing that someday. That would be kind of cool. And have like a stuffed owl or something.
Yeah.
All right.
Dr. Midnight.
Dr. Midnight. We're gonna work. Let it all work out.
I always think like I would like to do Brother Power the Geek too. But I'd have to be
Nice.
lanky and skinny for that one.
Maybe
I'd
you
have
could
to lose a
request
lot of weight for that. I'd be like
that.
this fat and I'd say, "No, I'm Brother Power the Geek, but I got stuffed with extra stuffing." Especially with my long hair now, I think I'd be a good hippie. And
Yeah.
that's what a Brother Power the Geek was.
Right.
He was a doll that was a hippie.
That'd be hilarious.
Such an interesting history on that one too, because when he was created, the editors hated it because they didn't like to promote hippies in their comics, because they thought they were like. Some of the editors thought they were bad for society, like not wanting
Yeah,
to do shit and not contributing to the workforce.
they were the counterculture.
Yeah. But, oh well. So, what comic-wise, what do you got?
Comics. I did read some comics. I have had
Comics.
for a while volume 5 of Animal Man, the Vertigo. I talked about a year and a half ago about volume 4 just in total. Which was the first volume that they released in a long time. They had only originally had just the first three Grant Morrison volumes, and I guess because of the New 52 and stuff, they started trading the issues that came after that. I'd bought volume four and read it pretty quickly, like I said, about a year and a half ago, and I ordered volume five and have had it sitting around. They called this volume the meaning of flesh. It starts with, I read the first two issues. It starts with issue 38. So I read 38 and 39. 38's got an interesting cover. I think by this point, Animal Man was known to have interesting creative covers. It's like a comic cover on a cover where a company called Collateral Damage Comics has a character named the Penalizer, blood-soaked first issue. It starts out where you think you don't realize you're reading maybe a comic within a comic about the Penalizer, the issue that we see on the cover. We read a couple pages of that as Animal Man's son and his friend are in their room reading the same issue, and it transitions over to the real world. And we see them reading the, and he's pretty much a Punisher takeoff, but just more extreme, more right wing and more violent, and if that such a thing is possible, just completely unconcerned for Collateral Damage, as it were, the name of the fictional comic company that puts this issue out. But this issue, as were some of the ones towards the end of the last volume, was by Tom Veitch with art by Steve Dillon. So we get into the issue proper. It's dealing with the fallout from how Volume 4 ended, or Issue 37, where Buddy was at the zoo and all the animals in the zoo died, and he's thought to be responsible for that. And there's like a lot of media attention, and the stress of it, of the situation, ends up his wife takes their daughter, and they go to her mom's house to get a break from all the craziness, and Buddy's son stays with Buddy because he doesn't want to go. And over the course of the issue, Buddy, because he doesn't really understand what's going on, he doesn't know why all the animals in the zoo died, and he feels responsible even though he doesn't know what caused the situation. He's kind of deteriorating and he's really stressed out. Before his wife and daughter leave, his daughter says something weird about a rainbow man that she's talking to, and they think it's just an imaginary friend of hers. But towards the end of the issue, Buddy actually sees this Mr. Rainbow outside in the yard, and he goes out and he confronts this. Looks just kind of like a vague shape of a man that has all kinds of colors in it, and Buddy blasts it with this sort of ray of animal essence, like reaching into the M field that he taps into to get his animal powers. And the Rainbow Man turns into this more like monster, this big green monster with a huge mouth and claws and stuff. And Buddy kills it, and then it evaporates and a sort of rainbow colored mist, like the Rainbow Man had been. He's just like baffled by the whole situation, what's going on. And meanwhile, there's this subplot where, tying into that Penalizer comic, where Buddy's son and his friend, they go to this place, this abandoned house, and bust it up and get in trouble and stuff like that. It's kind of like a subplot to the issue. Issue 39 is also by Tom Veitch. This time the art's by Tom Mandrake. And it's kind of funny. There's reports of wolves on the run, on the loose, And they attack the San Diego Comic-Con, this large pack of Timberwolves. So there's a splash page for like the title page. Oh, an interesting Dick Giordano is actually the inker on this. But there's a splash page of wolves attacking cosplayers, speaking of which.
Do you know what year that was?
These would have came out. Let's see what the original copyright was. Originally, the issues in this volume came out in 91 and 92. So
Ah.
cover dates are August and September of 91. So yeah, there's like wolves attacking a guy and guys in Superman and Batman costume. There's actually an Animal Man cosplayer in the background and a Hawkman one and Flash. So these wolves are attacking the San Diego Comic-Con, and this guy named Dwayne, that's a friend of Buddy's, shows up, and it seems some time has passed since the last issue because Buddy hasn't been answering his mail, and he's unshaven, and it was a little jarring. I thought, did I miss an issue or something like that? And part of it was the change in art style, but I concluded that just some time has passed. Buddy kind of sorts through his mail, and when he's kind of letting himself go, and the reason this Dwayne guy is there is to tell him about these wolves that are on the run to see if he can get Animal Man to get his act together and do something about it. But Buddy just says, you know, Animal Man that you're thinking of, he doesn't exist anymore. He's been phased out. So Dwayne leaves and gets attacked by these wolves right outside the house. They're swarming over his car, and his son and his friend come back to the house and tell him what's going on outside. They get in trouble with Buddy because they actually have set that house on fire that they were in last issue, and Buddy knows that his son was up to it and hits him, causing Cliff, that's his son's name, and his friend just run from the house. So things are kind of on the family front getting worse. So Buddy, later on at night, Buddy kind of taps into he's been able to sense these wolves. But he goes out and he ends up sort of tapping into their spirit, and he rips off all his clothes and just starts running with the pack. And they come across these teenagers that are hanging out, having a bonfire on the beach, and they're attacked by the wolves, but they're also attacked by Buddy, who's buck naked. Then it flips to the next morning, and he's sleeping on a bed, and Cliff comes in and steals some money and a credit card from him and leaves a note that he's going to stay with their mom. So that guy Dwayne comes back. He wakes Buddy up, and Buddy's all cut up and bloody. Doesn't seem to remember what happened. And Dwayne's trying to help him out and tell him, you know, I think I got you a gig in a movie that you can work on. He's trying to figure out what's going on and with Buddy and his family and stuff. And so Buddy decides to pick up the phone and try to get in touch and talk to Ellen. And it's pretty desperate. He's pretty desperate at this point. He's like, I need to see you. I need to touch you. Meanwhile, this guy's just standing there. Sort of embarrassing situation. So instead of taking this guy up on his offer to be in this movie as a stunt man, he asked to borrow a few hundred dollars from him. And the last page we see that he's leaving San Diego in a car with a plan to do a 3-day drive across America to see his wife, but he knows something's stalking him, and that's unrelenting. And we see like a distant shot of his car on this highway driving through the desert, and the clouds are some just menacing looking creature. Like those clouds are in the shape of monsters and things. They're pretty cool. Issues pretty good. They're a little bit uneven at times in terms of following the like I said, the transition of the time shift in between the issues. I don't know if it was up to the fill-in art, but in the subplot, a lot of time doesn't seem to have gone on with Cliff. There doesn't seem to be much time has passed, but where we leave Buddy at the end of the first issue I read, and where he's at in the next issue, it seems a lot more time has passed. So that might be the way that the artist interpreted things. So that was a little bit jarring, but I think there's actually a volume six of this out as well. So I'm just glad that rather than have it's just been a lot easier than tracking down these issues. I'm glad that DC, even though they took such a long time in between the Grant Morrison issues and these other ones, I'm glad that they are trading all of these and making it convenient to pick them up.
I could have sworn I saw the latest volume in either this previews or the one before that.
Oh, like a
Another,
seventh.
yeah, after this one.
Well, I know there's a sixth one. I don't know if it's come
Oh,
out yet. I think that was traded a
maybe it's
while
the
ago.
seventh one then.
Yeah, which that's cool. I mean, it seems like at this point they're gonna do the whole thing, so that's nice. Since I mean, these issues, I don't think after the Morrison ones are hard to get, maybe, but
I think they're harder.
are they?
Well,
Okay.
I think because they're not well regarded like the Morrison ones, and they weren't ordered as much.
Yeah, that's true. So
I mean, they
I
might be
mean,
easier to find in a dollar bin if you can find them, but
Right.
I think they're harder to just find a run of them.
Yeah, like they might.
If you
Yeah,
have
it's just.
patience, you'll find them.
Right.
It'll be harder if you just want to bulk get them.
Yeah, would like they might not be expensive, but it would be hard to just find all of the issues you're looking for in one place. And I do that sometimes, but it's just sometimes it's like I'll just get the trade because I don't have to do like five different orders from five different places, you know?
Yeah.
So.
All right, what I have read 16 issues of Cobalt, which is a milestone comic from
Nice.
1994 to 1995, and I just received it on Friday, and I actually read the entire series.
Yeah, nice.
What I will say that a lot of people won't like this, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. I enjoyed it because it was different and it was bizarre, and it may seem like a train wreck to some people, but I enjoyed it. Such an interesting character. If you look at his design, and I don't know if you've seen Cobalt, but he has like these Road Warrior shoulder pads with spikes coming out of them. He's got one hand, it looks like it's made out of cyber stuff. One hand's wrapped in a chain, and sometimes he has these claws that he'll attach to his arms and use as weapons. And he's got a lot of weapons. He's got an armory, which they don't really tell you a lot about. Some interesting things is John Byrne did the cover for issue number one. It was created by John Rosum, and the artist was Arvell Jones. The artists have changed through three different. Arvell Jones did like the first six. Jamal Igel did issue seven. This one was interesting because I didn't expect to run into a Jamal Igel issue, and I posted it on Facebook. And it turns out that is his first cover that Jamal Igel's done, and it's probably his third work. Interiors that he's done. So that's kind of an interesting fact for a friend that I talk to at all the conventions, Jamal Igel. And
And I was gonna say that must be earlier work for him.
Yeah, it was issue number 7. This series ran from 1994 to 1995. It didn't have a long run. It didn't have a lot of letters pages, but those that read it loved it. And it was just bizarre. And let me tell you why it's bizarre. 16 issues, and you still don't know who Cobalt is. Cobalt doesn't have an alias, so he doesn't have, like, I'm going to turn into Cobalt, or I'm going to be my Clark Kent during the day and turn into Cobalt at night. He's Cobalt 24 fucking 7. And he's always dressed in this costume. What there was one issue where he went undercover to his sidekick's house as a dressed as a cop without his costume on, but that was the only issue where he appeared out of costume. You learn nothing of his backstory, absolutely nothing. You don't know about his powers. You just see that he's kind of an ordinary guy with a lot of weapons. And he doesn't like to fight guys that have powers if he could avoid it because he knows his limitations. And the first issue is just fucking bizarre. It introduced you to this violent character, this vigilante who's not known to the police very well. He's very obscure and he's like the Sasquatch. He's like Bigfoot. People don't believe that he exists, but everybody is like. It reminded me of we were talking about Michael Keaton's Batman. Do you remember those two crooks when they first introduced Batman and they were trying to describe him? They were just like, yeah, he was hanging, and he was like talking to the police. That's what the way these guys talk to the police. It's Cobalt, man. It's Cobalt, and he doesn't. Nobody believes him. There's one police chief that they have maybe in 5 issues, and they look like they're going to build her character, but they never do. And the first issue, what makes the first issue so freaking bizarre is they don't tell you any of his origin or anything. They just throw you into a situation where he's beating up people trying to expose this organization that he's after. All 16 issues called Saint Cloud. He's after this guy. And he does drug dealing and guns, and he supplies guns to all the gang members, and he's trying to stop it. But what's interesting is they introduce this guy Richard Page, and he seems like he's like your Peter Parker, like he is a young kid in high school. He's getting beat up for his lunch money. He's getting beat up all the time. He's kind of a loner. Looked as an outsider, and this character is so weird. It's like, what? Why does the father all of a sudden the father picks up his phone once, or he sees his son has like a costume in his room, like he's trying to be a superhero because of the Dakota incident, and he knows he collects comics, so he makes a phone call, a mysterious phone call, and he calls Cobalt, and he's like. And this guy's a congressman. He's like, you owe me because of what I did for you many years ago. They never ever say what he did for him in 16 issues, but it's like, you owe me. I want you to take my son as a sidekick. I'm like, why does his father want his son to be a sidekick, risking his life with Cobalt?
Holy cow.
And Cobalt is like, I don't want to take in a sidekick. He's like, I fucking had. Three sidekicks die already. I have one that's a vigilante called Harvest that's shooting up everybody, and I have another one that's a female that I want to detach myself from because I don't want any sidekicks. And he's like, "You owe me one. You're gonna have to train him." So a couple issues he does the Mr. Miyagi thing. You know, he's like, "You got to learn balance," and he like has these two step ladders, and he like makes him walk on a thin stick up all the way the ladder, all the way across, and then if he falls, he has to start again. And then he makes him go to the roof and learn balance on the ledges, and he shoots tennis balls at him. All kinds of tennis balls. He has like these tennis ball cannons, and he's shooting them at it. And he trains this guy. He has no powers. And then they decide to get him a costume, and the costume maker makes him like this very Kirby-esque costume. And the media brands him Page, which is his last name, just spelled a little differently.
Oh,
So it's like, what are you doing to me? And every time he goes out in this costume, he had to pay for this costume. And Cobalt's like, I can't be seen with this guy. It's like flamboyant. I'm all dark. I don't even show my, I show all my chest hairs, and I strike fear into the villains, and you're dressed like this. I can't have a sidekick like this. I think it was kind of like poking at the Robin thing, because you have like Batman and then you have colorful Robin. And so he's like, he tells the costume designer, you have to make another costume. And he goes, well, I can do that, but this fabric's very hard to work with and it'll cost you $2,000. And Cobalt's like, nope, we'll take the costume. Let's go.
Jeez.
So he has no powers, but he does have a run-in with Static. He goes into the same high school as Static, and they fight this fly guy. But there's a lot of cool scenes in there where he like makes a fly trap with sticky paper to catch this fly guy, and he's got this cheerleader girlfriend that he's after, and he sticks the cheerleader on his shoulders, and he's getting a boner, and he's like, I gotta try to concentrate because I'm right here near her crotch, and he's getting a
Oh
boner.
yeah, I think I saw you post that panel.
Yeah, and then there's another great scene with Harvest, who's the vigilante, and this guy has no mercy. He's after the same corporation, St. Cloud, to stop the guns. He's really against guns, but he uses guns all the time. And this guy doesn't care who he shoots up. Like, he'll go in with guns blazing into a hotel room, shoot it, and then he kills everybody next door and the next door next to that, and he doesn't give a shit. But there's one scene where he like armors up, and then his stomach starts gurgling. And he needs to take a shit like really bad. And he's like, oh man, I wish I would have not. He spent a whole page drawing panels of him armoring up and then his stomach gurgling and needing to take a shit and running to the bathroom. But yeah,
I
there's
bet
some.
that happens a lot more than comics depicts for us.
It has some greatness in it. It has. Some run-ins with Hardware, which looks like he might be working with the St. Cloud organization somehow. And then it has a run-in with Virgil, who's Static. And also in the last few issues, they show the Blood Syndicate. So I really enjoyed this ride. I thought it was funny. I thought it was different. And I thought it was bizarre because the thing that kept driving me towards finishing this is I want to know what this character's about, and I never learned anything about him. Other than he had sidekicks, a couple of them died. He has, other sidekicks. He's got an armory, and he likes to beat up bad guys to try to take down the St. Cloud guy. And the book ends with him. There's this amusement park like Epcot Center, and there's a huge battle that goes on because they're the ones. Guys trying St. Cloud's trying to set up Cobalt so he could take him down, and he eventually fakes his death, and that's how the book ends, because he says if I fake my death I could still go after St. Cloud and he won't know about it. But that's how it ends. And then he tells his other sidekick, who is a female that's infatuated with him as a hero but not sexually, her name is Clover, and he says you'll have to take over the training of Paige. And so she tells Paige, I'll have to take the training, but Paige decides that he's done. He wants to hang up his costume. So that's how it ends. But there's some crazy villains that he fights. Slick, Red Light, and Volt early on in the issues. There's Hook, Line, and Sinker, who
Nice.
he takes out in a single panel. And there's Dozer, and it's an entertaining book. The book started off at $1.75 cover price, and then toward and I, it had the paper I liked, which was the non-gloss paper. And then in issue 13, they raised the cover price to $2.50, and they changed the cover, the stock of the paper, which was almost like the paper we have today, just slightly different. I actually liked it better, because it didn't reflect as bad as the current paper. But yeah, it was good. And I got to see a couple of Zero Hour ads because this happened around Zero Hour, which was a lot of fun, being that I had listened to Comics and History. And yeah, I read Cobalt. And my next one, I'm going on those that know me is I'm collecting Dead Universes, and I finished a lot of them already, and my next Dead Universe is Milestone. So the next books that I'm getting are Static, a full run of Static, and a full run of Hardware.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't read much Milestone. I did get interested in it, and read a couple of the first. The way they rolled it out was they started with one series and then they kept adding them until they had their original ones rolling. And then the one you just talked about, Cobalt, was one of the ones that they added later on.
Yeah, he came as the same as Zombie, spelled
Zombie,
with an
yeah.
X.
So I just read a few, a couple issues of Hardware, which is the first one that they launched, a couple issues of Icon, and a couple issues of Blood Syndicate. Those are the first three series, and then the fourth was Static.
Pro those are probably the most popular ones, those four right there.
Yeah, those were the longest running. But yeah, I wonder if, they eventually were going to planning to reveal more about Cobalt, and they just didn't have a chance to since the line closed. But
Well, that it's interesting that you mentioned that because it sounded like it came to an abrupt end because of sales. It wasn't selling what they needed it to sell. And John Rosen wrote an article. He's like, "Yeah, I had this planned," and he was eventually going to get to his origin. I don't know how farther down the line, but he was. And he was also going to tell us about like all his sidekicks, that he had. Or more and more about Harvest, that bloodthirsty vigilante one. But it didn't work out, and it sounded like it never did. But yeah, it's I don't know. I love comics history, and I love to see like what was coming out at the time. And this was an entertaining read. It was very fast. 90s comics, man, they were in your face with art. And there was a lot of depth and story there, but it wasn't a lot of character building. It was weird. It was very, I will say it's the most unique book I've ever read because it didn't, usually by 16 issues, you've developed the character's origin, or you've at least told what he likes, what he doesn't like, his pet peeves. All we know is that he's against this corporation who he never takes down. He gets close, but he never takes down. And then he had a bunch of sidekicks that didn't pan out. And he owes this congressman a favor. And that is the weirdest part of Cobalt, is why would this congressman call a vigilante and say, "Take my 16-year-old son and turn him into a vigilante?"
Well, you said that he discovered his son was sort of interested in the superheroes, right?
And he was interested in the superheroes, and he was getting beat up, and I guess his father knew that.
Yeah. So the only thing I could think of was one of those situations, like he realized, my son's gonna pursue this path whether I help him out or not. So at least if he's gonna do it, at least I can get him somebody to help him,
Yeah, and he has a sister, and his sister knows his origin. And it was panning out where he was building this relationship with this girl, because he saved her life during a attack at a gym, and she's got this abusive boyfriend, but we never found out what happened. Like, I don't know what was going to happen with that. So there was a lot of untied threads, but it was very enjoyable, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it sounds like even though it got canceled abruptly, it's still worth reading.
Yeah, a lot of people though, I tell you, they'll get frustrated. The because a lot of the complaints people say is it's so decompressed or whatever, and you never learn about this character. Well, you never learn about it. You have to have patience. And I still don't know about him, but maybe that's okay. I don't care. It was an entertaining read.
Well, I think you probably help other people out now so they can know that going in and
Yeah.
that they won't go in with that expectation and they can just focus on what they are getting,
Right.
which I think can help a lot. What your expectations affect you a lot,
Yeah, and I'm a DC guy. And while I did buy some Milestone back in the day, I only read like the first few issues of the books that you just mentioned. And I don't have complete runs of it, so I have a ways to go to finish this line. And one of the things to mention is this was a company of diversity. That's what they were launched as. So they have a lot of diverse characters. And they say they were offering something different. This book doesn't feel really different as far as diverse, because the guy Page was a son of a white congressman, and Cobalt, you never know what his nationality is, other than he looks like a white barbarian Caucasian. Don't know anything else.
No, but if you read the early issues of Hardware, Icon, Blood Syndicate, and stuff like that, you can tell they were really going for to do some be a different sort of voice in comics. And Icon was really interesting because they Icon himself was a conservative African American man, and they were purposely making that choice to represent, to bring a different character, a different sort of person that you don't see depicted in the media a lot. And I as someone who's not of a conservative background and stuff, in terms of, like, politically, I'm speaking, it's just interesting to see a character that's different, and that's across the board. I mean, they were trying to bring in characters that were of race and gender and stuff that were underrepresented in comics. So it's pretty, I would say it's pretty historically important company if you're interested in comic book history.
Yeah, it is. And
Hopefully.
I'm learning a lot, but you got to also mention that Icon was not only a conservative, but he was an alien.
Well, he was kind of he's kind of a take on Superman,
Superman, yeah.
yeah.
But they
And his
also dealt with
sidekick
things like
Ricochet,
they dealt with things like Rocket getting pregnant,
or
right?
Rocket. Yeah, I said Ricochet.
Yeah. Teenage pregnancy
Yeah,
in
early on,
later
like,
issues.
Blood Syndicate, they had a member, or at least a member, if not a couple, that were just different, like different, especially like different African American cultural voices, like were represented there. You had a character that was what is the movement? But it's the it was related to Malcolm X. Shit.
I don't
But
know a lot of.
yeah, if I think about it much, but ultimately, I mean, it's a very cool, interesting company. Milestone would be, hopefully we haven't seen in the last of the characters.
Yeah, we saw them recently in. Well, we saw Static in the New 52 relaunch. I'm not sure if we've seen any others. I know that a lot of them were in the Justice League books by James Robinson before the New 52 launched. And
Well,
we
I
did
mean,
have Milestone. What were you going to say?
Hardware was in Static, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he was. Yeah. All right, so what else do you got?
So I read a couple more issues of Green Lantern from where the last issue I talked about on the podcast, 128. So from the same era, the early 80s. 127 that I talked about last time kind of wrapped up storyline that had been running for several issues with the Webner's Accord and stuff, at least wrapped up the main plot of that story. And with issue 128, which continues being the team of Denny O'Neil and Joe Staton, well, it sort of continues that team. I'll explain in a second. We see Hal coming back to Earth to check in because ever since he ended his partnership with Green Arrow and tried to get his job back with Ferris Aircraft, he really hasn't been around too much because he's been dealing with this threat of the Webboners. So he gets back and is greeted by Tom Kalamaku, and Carol Ferris is, as usual, pissed at him because, like I said, she's given him another chance to work for her company, and he hasn't been around much. She knows he's Green Lantern and everything like that. She knows what she's been doing. And surprisingly, this kid, it wasn't from the issue that I covered on this podcast, but when he was several issues ago, when Hal was about to enter the portal to the to Cord, a little kid named Fabian followed him in there in a Superman shirt. Well, I just thought that this was just a dumb kid who was putting himself in danger and making things more difficult for GL, but it turns out the he's still around, and Carol's been looking after him. But the bulk of this issue is while they're standing around talking, all of a sudden a voice issues from Hal's ring, says, "Be careful, Lantern." And they're surprised to everyone else is surprised to never heard the power ring talk. So like and so he goes on to tell a story, and he says, "The ring's not exactly talking. Let me tell you a story to explain." And the story that tells to explain is actually done by a different creative team. It's it's the bulk of the issue. It's by Len Wein and Dave Cockrum. I mean, I was kind of wondering, was this a reprint? And I don't think it was. I don't know if it was a stock story that they just had in hadn't used because maybe they needed to, because Denny O'Neil, he's really close to, I think the next issue is his last on the book, or it's close to being the end for him. So maybe they needed some to fill things in. So Hal tells this story about where he comes up against Hector Hammond, and Hector Hammond is to make a long story short, even though he's in the state pen, he has found a way to slowly drain power off of Green Lantern, and he's absorbing power in short bits, and then when he builds up enough power, he uses it as a sort of energy exoskeleton, restores his mobility, and actually for a little while he tells Hal that he's been flying into outer space looking for the meteor who the meteor that fragments of the meteor that had originally changed him, given him the huge brain and huge head. They end up battling in space. Hector absorbs some more power from him, and is using it to using his Hal's power against him, basically. And they end up having like an arm wrestling battle with constructs of hands that they're both creating. Hal beats him, of course. But the point of the story is this was the adventure that Hal was on, where he realized that the ring doesn't talk so much as that it is that it's actually Hal's own subconscious projected into the ring in the form of a voice. So it's as Tom Kalamaku puts it, it says things Hal doesn't know that he knows. So that, and that's basically it. And then in the conclusion of the story, we find out that Fabian is not who we think he is. As Carol takes him to his bedroom, puts him to bed, he gets right back out of bed and thinking to himself, "That foolish woman. Her puny heart would freeze if she knew the boy Fabian is actually the Quartian general fabricant."
Oh no.
So he puts on, so he puts on this like blue jumpsuit with a hol like a gun holster and stuff, and it turns out that Fabian is actually the general fabricant of the weaponers. So that was kind of neat, interesting little plot development there I didn't see coming. And then issue 129 is a Star Sapphire story.
I really like the cover on that one.
It's, yeah, it's an interesting cover. It's actually got Hal Jordan and his like this is by Denny O'Neil and Joe Staton. And it opens and Hal is flying around his Green Lantern in a rainstorm, and he's looking for one of the other Ferris aircraft pilots who is testing a plane and being really irresponsible. And lightning strikes and cracks one of the plane's arms, and Hal has to save the guy from dying, crashing and dying. But the test pilot, they call him Rideout. He's like a cowboy sort of guy. He's not in the least fazed by the situation, not at all scared. And Hal finds himself in the unusual predicament of telling this guy to respect his employer, which the irony of which is not lost on Carol. Points out that he's not acting much different than Hal did when he was first a test pilot. So Fabian, who we know now is actually General Fabricant, he goes to Coast City Police Museum, and he steals the gem that's related to the Star Sapphire power, well, the Star Sapphire. And he knows that Carol Ferris in the past has been the Star Sapphire, even though she's not aware of that herself. He exposes her to the staff Star Sapphire while she's sleeping, and she turns into the Star Sapphire, and he sets her off after Hal Jordan tells her to kill Hal Jordan, and he's telepathically controlling her via the Star Sapphire. So Hal gets in a fist fight with the test pilot that he corrected earlier, a bit of like macho egos. This other test pilot doesn't realize that, Hal's actually Green Lantern and in quite good shape, and quite a hand-to-hand combat person. When Hal sees Star Sapphire, so he's like, "Oh shit, I gotta go. I gotta suit up and go after her." So Star Sapphire, she thinks that she's blasted the area she saw Hal Jordan, so she thinks that she's killed him, goes back and reports as such. And when Fabricant Ironically, he had sent her to kill Hal Jordan as a test to warm her up for killing Green Lantern, not knowing that they're one and the same. So he tells her to do that when Hal just shows up. This is when the whole link between Fabian and General Fabricant is revealed, and it's kind of neat that it's Hal reveals that he's known that there was some kind of connection, because that little bit of dialogue that they heard from the ring, where it said, "Be careful, Green Lantern," he knew that that was actually a warning from what was going on, but distracted the situation by just going into that story and everything like that, that it was his subconscious telling him something was going on. So Fabricant, he actually takes off the Fabian mask. So he's not the boy himself, obviously. At first I did actually kind of think that Fabricant had some kind of like possessed his body or something, but he's just wearing a mask because he's a little guy, but he
Yeah.
could be. So there's a bit of a showdown where continues to try to control Carol and have her destroy Hal. Hal's able to use his ring to disrupt some of the Star Sapphire itself that's on her hat like thing. Star Sapphire, Carol, she becomes more and more unstable. Thinks because so there's a reference to the cover here. She thinks she's seeing Hal and Green Lantern at the same time. He's able to get behind her and get the Star Sapphire off of her head to disrupt the control. As Hal gets ready to send General Fabricant back to Quird, Carol comes to, doesn't know anything. She doesn't remember anything that happens when she's Star Sapphire, so Hal just lies to her, so she doesn't still continues to not know.
Yeah.
And I think that this is, I'm trying to see where I thought I saw it in the letters or something like that back here, where they're saying that this is they're going to be, or maybe it's next issue where they're saying goodbye to Denny O'Neil after being on the book for so long.
Yeah,
So,
130, it's Bob
okay.
Rozakis.
Yeah.
So it's not him.
So at the end of a
Joe
very long stretch.
Staton's still there though.
Yeah, he stays on, but Denny O'Neil, very long run. He kind of, stayed on for 6 issues or so to sort of set up a new status quo and do one story and a couple one shots. But these were fun to read. I like Joe Staton's art and Denny O'Neil's writing. I think a lot of his writing from the 70s and 80s, I mean, really still stands up
Yeah, he's good.
pretty solid. So, these aren't the best known of his work on Green Lantern, but it's very solid storytelling. He knows what he's an expert at this point, So,
Cool. 1980.
yeah.
Well, I'm gonna jump forward to 2001. We got Batman Legends of the Dark Knight number 137. This is part one of five called Terror. And scene opens up where there's this weird house near the ocean. It looks really weird. It looks like Kelly Jones artwork because of the way, how narrow and weird it looks. But Doug Munch does the writing, Paul Galassi does the pencilers, and our friend Jimmy Palmiotti does the inks.
Nice.
So you see a Batman entering this building, and he walks through in the first few pages, and then he pulls out a knife on this old man that looks kind of like Einstein, and he takes the knife and sticks it right into his chest and kills him, and then he smears the blood of his chest on the wall and uses his blood to paint a bat on the wall. and leaves. And you see when he turns around that it's Hugo Strange. It's that motherfucker that psychiatrist that dresses up like Batman all the time and has that factuation with Batman, and he kills him. And let me set the framework for this. At this point in time, Batman and Commissioner Gordon think that Hugo Strange is dead, but he's not. Batman breaks up a gun running meetup, and they have a lot of guns, and he actually breaks it up, destroys the guns, but a few guys try to get away in a boat. And what's interesting about this is he goes after them in the bat boat and he torches them. He sets them on, he sets the whole boat on fire. And all the guys jump out, and he goes, "Maybe I'm getting too violent. Maybe I need to cut back a little bit." He says, "I think I'm going a little bit overboard, as there's a huge flame coming from the boat, and the guys are almost drowning." So that was kind of interesting. And then the bat signal comes. Commissioner Gordon tells him, "Hey, all the signs point to you. The dagger has a bat symbol on it. There's a bat painted on the wall. I know you didn't commit the crime, but somebody's trying to frame you for committing it." And they think it's Hugo Strange, but they're like, "He's dead. You know, is it be a copycat or something like that?" And then the scene cuts to where Hugo Strange is hiding out in a shack somewhere, and he's cooking beans, and he has this girl dressed in bra and panties, or I'd say not even panties. This looks like a thong with a bat cowl on it. And she looks hypnotized. Her eyes are like wide open, and she's smiling like she took some Smilex from the Joker. And he's talking to her like you'd talk to anybody. And he's eating his beans as he's looking at this naked girl and telling her that he's gonna take down the Batman or set him up and make him look bad. And then they introduce Catwoman. She's stealing some stuff, and at the very end, it gets really interesting because there's an opening at Arkham Asylum, and Hugo Strange gets the job as an alias, Victor Obonus, and he's it shows him hypnotizing Jonathan Crane, the Scarecrow, at the end, and then he was going to go to Joker's, I think, sell next. So we'll see where that turns out, but it was a good it was a good interesting issue. Hugo Strange story from 2001.
Nice. Yeah, not only does Hugo Strange want to be Batman, he wants to fuck
He does. And it's creepy, man. He has this girl there and she's just smiling and he's talking to her, eating his beans, you know, that he just cooked on his fireplace. And yeah, it's a pretty creepy scene.
We don't call him Strange for nothing. Well, I just have one more issue. I read another issue of Legion, following from the one I talked about before. I read 263, and this is continues kind of a transition period before Paul Levitt starts writing the book. This is by Jerry Conway, with art by Jimmy Janes and Dave Hunt, and it's called Day of Judgment. As they kind of continuing to do at this time period, they focus on some members of the team that haven't been in the last 5 or 6 issues or so, where they have them kind of named on the cover. They have where it's Tyrak, Shadow Lass, Chameleon Boy, Wildfire, and later on Dawnstar comes into it. It's called Day of Judgment, I think I said, and it starts off with the Legion headquarters has been newly rebuilt from the battle, and it was destroyed in issue 251 when it was still Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, and a battle with the villain named Omega. And five parents of the Legion members are coming to the newly rebuilt headquarters and walking through. They go to a room where there's statues of current and former legionnaires. They show a panel where currently deceased Legion members Feral Lad, Invisible Kid, and Chemical King are being paid tribute to, all killed in action. And this weird sounding voice comes from off panel, mocking out Joe Na, the father of Ultra Boy. And it's this guy in this crazy green armor called Dagon the Avenger. He's got green horns and stuff, and he's depicted on the cover as well, battling the Legionnaires.
He actually looks like something out of the Micronauts.
Yeah, good call. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jonah, he just thinks it's kind of like a joke, and starts laughing, but only to get blasted and taken out. But he's Dagon is using, as you want to say, Dagon, anesthetic darts, to knock them out. So the mother of Chameleon Kid turns into a saber-toothed tiger and attacks, and he takes them all out. But then he's like, one of them's missing. Arne Digby of Imsk, father of the vixen known as Shrinking Violet. And sure enough, he's shrunk himself down like his daughter, and tries attacking Dagon's ankle with a blaster to knock him over. Dagon keeps bragging about he's come very well prepared for this moment. He's got the power set up to take out all these, to combat all these characters. Well, one other parent, the parent of Shadowlass, has gotten away, is watching from the shadows behind one of the Legion statues, and she's trying to communicate using a communicator in her palm, but Dagon's got a interrupter field going. And he finds her, and she fights him off a bit and tries to run to escape. In the course of the battle, she's actually fighting in front of the statue of her daughter, and she ducks, and the base of Shadowlass's statue is busted up a little bit. It looks like it's gotten shot by a gun. And then her mom's unable to get away. As we close this scene, we see she's lying at Dagon's feet, and he's laughing. So we switch over to the Legionnaires. There are a bunch of them are coming back, like the ones that are prominent in the story, and Lightning Lad and a couple others, Dreamer, I think. And they're surprised to see that the damage to Shadowlass's statue. But then it's unclear what she sees, but Shadowlass sees something else on the statue. It's sparkling. Oh, no, actually, it is clear. It's her mother's belt. She kind of left as a sign to her daughter that's like, why is my mom's belt here? So they're confused. They don't know, why is my mom here? Why was she here? What's wrong? Where is she? They do some research, check on some other of their parents and find out that Shadowlass's mother's not the only one, the only parents supposedly on Earth. That the parents of Ultra Boy, Chameleon Boy, Shrinking Violet are supposed to be there as well. So they're like, well, then where the hell are they? What's going on? And Wildfire says, well, my parents live right here on Earth. What's going on with them? And it says, the computer says that his parents are missing as well, along with Colossal Boys and Sun Boys. So They figure out, well, someone must be kidnapping parents of the Legionnaires. It's like, well, if someone's kidnapping parents and we need to track somebody down, we have the best tracker in the universe on our team, Dawnstar. So we scene shifts to Dawnstar. She's in space. She's like rescuing a couple, and while they're waiting for her to arrive, Tyrak finds out that something is going on with his family. But before they're able to resolve that, Wildstar arrives and they give her the lowdown. In the middle of the meeting, Tyrak leaves. And Wildstar and Shadowlass are like, our parents are missing. What the hell are you doing? Why are you leaving? And he says, the people on my island need me. It's a crucial time for the people of Marzul. And this disc on his belt tells him that he has no choice, but he's got to go back. And he's asking for forgiveness, and actually Wildfire straight up tries to attack him. And it actually seems to cause him to dissipate. I'm not really sure. I'm not real familiar with Tyrak's powers. I don't know what actually happens here. Like, he reaches out.
Tyrak is like he could do like a Black Canary. It's sound based.
Okay, because he screams, but Wildfire seems to put his fist through him.
His fist through Tyrak?
Yeah, I think he's
But
using his belt to teleport or something.
cuz
And
Wildfire's energy, like
right.
he has to be in costume to actually have physical form. I wonder
Yeah,
if he just phased through him or something. I don't know.
I think he was in the process of phasing out.
Or maybe Tyrak has some kind of weird ability. I don't know.
Yeah, because it doesn't seem like that. They don't seem concerned. He says Wildfire is just shouting that he's gonna see him kicked out of the league, and then everyone's else like, look, we'll deal with this later. We gotta focus on the situation at hand. So, yeah, I mean, I'm just more familiar with Legionnaires that have been picked up and used in some of the other later volumes, and which Tyrak has not been. So the way it ends, like, it continues, the story continues into the next issue, but I think it's late last here that is talking about how the new headquarters, the three Brand Enterprises employees that were setting up the security systems for the new headquarters and were supposed to be working on the protection of their parents, were all laid off, coincidentally, and they all blamed the Legion for the financial problems that RJ Brand has been having. So they're suspecting that those are the people that are behind all of this. But then Dagon uses some sort of powers to c communicate with them as a head appears floating in the air near them, and he says, you must realize now that your security is compromised. I know your secrets and your powers, and I'm able to repulse any attempts you have to get to your loved ones. And he shows up with the ransom here. He demands 1 billion solar credits be delivered to him. Otherwise, their parents will all be killed. It was a pretty good issue. This is kind of, lead up, not in terms of the storyline, but just this time period. Now, looking back, and we know in history that eventually Paul Levitt's run is coming up. So, but I do like that they're taking a time with the different stories. The stories don't last too long. They're like one or two issues right now, and they make a point of cycling and using different characters that are on the team instead of trying to fit everybody in. And it kind of, in a way, that kind of keeps things fresh. So it's that I like that. That seems to kind of work. So.
So 264, it's still continued or?
Yeah, I didn't read that yet. But yeah, the storyline continues in there. It's got some of the same legionnaires on the cover battling. Oh, this might be a clue here, because on the cover of 264, Tyrak is saying, "You can fight that menace yourselves, legionnaires," meaning Dagon. "I'm using my super voice powers to teleport out of here." Ew! So I guess he's able to teleport with his voice power somehow.
Very cool costume.
Yeah. One
That's
thing
what
about this Legion.
that's what you should go as. Don't do Dr. Midnight, go as Tyrock.
Yeah, that's quite a costume.
Because you could go as like 70s there, because that's so 70s.
I know, it's very 70s looking.
I don't
It's
know.
actually like Buck
I don't know
Rogers in
why
some
they
ways.
had to draw people with that V chest if they were black. They felt like they had to. You can't find too many characters that didn't have that. Luke Cage, right? Black Lightning. Well, Black Panther was fully clothed, but he came before. He came in the 12 cent issues. But man, I don't know why they had to dress him like this.
Yeah, I mean I have read, I think, some things, not necessarily talking about comics, but about like blaxploitation films and cinema and stuff like that, about treatment of like African American men, and like treating them as sexual people, like emphasizing their sexuality, like in the same way you talk about like the like racist perspective that black people are really good at sports just because they're naturally that way, as if they don't work the same way for for it as other people. So, I mean, there could be something of that to it. But at the same time, I do think it's kind of cool that the flip side of that is that, like, you can't say that the Legion weren't equal opportunity in their skimpy outfits.
With
And
Shadow Glass.
Cosmic Boy was, his was pretty
His was the worst.
funky, yeah, and
But that
had
was the
some,
Mike
he was
Grell
showing some
years,
skin.
right? Mike Grell, he had the
Yeah.
court. He looked like he was wearing one of those things where the corsets or whatever they call them.
Yeah, corset.
Yeah, corsets. And then Shadowlass is pretty skimpy, even on the cover to 1-264.
Yeah,
I
her
like
costume's just a
Dawnstar. I thought
bikini, pretty
Dawnstar
much.
was pretty sexy. My
Yeah.
two sexy Legionnaires are Dawnstar and I like Night Girl, which you don't see too often.
Yeah. It actually has a similar interpretation of of future fashion to Buck Rogers. Like it's the future, so people dress, they show more skin.
Yeah. All
But
right.
so that wraps it up for me.
All right, so I got one more. Batman Gotham Knights number 42. And I've covered a lot of these Gotham Knights books. And this doesn't leave off where I left off last, so I'll bring you up to speed. What happened to the issues in between was Checkmate was trying to infiltrate the Batcave. And they went in through the Huntress to try to attack the Huntress. And eventually everything. Checkmate was foiled and everything was back to normal. But during the storyline, and then there was a one shot in between with Ralph and Sue Dibny, which is pretty interesting. But there was a during the course of these Checkmate issues, you see Alfred's health degrading, and you don't know why, other than he's talking to Leslie and about his health, but he won't tell anybody else about his health. But what makes this interesting is you have Alfred historically in a hospital bed right now in Batman Eternal, and he's in a
True.
hospital bed in this year, which is 2003.
Yeah.
So Scott Beatty writes this, David Ross is on pencils, and it's called 20 Days, One Less One. And it opens up with Leslie Tompkins treating Alfred, and she actually finds out during Contagion, there was that, the big bad event, Contagion. I don't know if you read it or not. The
I know
virus
of it,
was
yeah.
released. Well, they stopped that virus. But what happens in this storyline is Alfred contracted the virus, and you're like, well, how the hell did he contract the virus? Well, during Contagion, Tim got the virus, and Alfred was treating him in the Batcave. And even though they've been inoculated with the cure, the virus mutated as it went into the bats in the cave, and the bats were holding it like a virus, and as they pooped and stuff, it became a virus, and Alfred caught this virus, and
Because he was eating the poop on toast.
he was eating toast. Yeah, he was eating shit on a whatever they call it,
Shingle.
shingle, shit on a shingle. But Alfred's not doing too good, and Bruce is, it's affecting Bruce pretty bad, and this goes like day one, waiting for the hardest part, and they think Alfred's gonna die. Day two's quarantine. Once he realizes what's happening, he quarantines his whole team, and they get inoculated, and then you even have the Justice League get involved, and the Atom specifically looking at cell structures and stuff. And cabin fever, because they're quarantined, when the bat signal goes up, Bruce can't go out. So he has to have other people come in. And here's really interesting. He tapped into Alan Scott to work with
Nice.
Commissioner Atkins, which was the commissioner at the time. And there was a good, interesting thing. He says, he said the regular fellow is preoccupied at the moment. He'll be back soon enough, Commissioner Atkins. And Commissioner Atkins is just, his jaw has just dropped. And he's like, I had your decoder ring when I was a kid. I got it in a box of Cracker Jacks. 'Cause
Nice.
you got to remember that these guys were World War II heroes, and when crisis happened, they kind of got merged in with them.
Right.
So he's shocked to be seeing like a legend in front of him. And then Tim is there, and he's blaming himself, and he's like texting, he's talking to Stephanie, the spoiler, and he's saying, it's all my fault. I brought the clench here. And Leslie says, oh, it's not your fault. There's nothing you could have done about it. And day six is when they found that the bat droppings and stuff was carrying the virus, and they needed to find the cure for this virus, or anybody else in the cave would get it. So he locks up the cave. He basically says, no one else is, he seals the cave and says, until we get a cure for this, no one's to enter or enter the cave, and he seals it up. He puts it on lockdown. Meanwhile, the Atom is trying to find out what the virus is and how to attack it. And then there's a scene with Cassandra, who was Batgirl at the time. And you got to remember that Cassandra never really spoke. She was
Right.
a woman of motion, and she's looking for a get well card for Alfred. And she just signs a card and it says, I will feel sad until you are better. So that was kind of emotional if you actually see the card. On day 10, Bruce makes his attempt at making Alfred some chicken soup, and he fails dramatically, and then decides to order it out.
That's cute.
But on day 11, it's cheap theatrics, and this is an emotional scene. It's really awesome. Bruce sits down and he starts reading. Alfred hasn't said a word in days, and he starts reading Shakespeare to Alfred. And Alfred actually completes the sentence of one of the quotes, and that means, hey, maybe he's on his road to recovery. So once that happens, then Batman goes back out because they actually have found the cure. The Atom helped with it, Ray Palmer, and they all get inoculated, and the cure's starting to work on Alfred's system, so he lifts the quarantine, he goes out and beats the hell out of the Riddler. And meanwhile, there's this story that's been building on in this storyline, and it's about this social worker who's trying to arrest Bruce for his abuses to children, and he's attacking him through Jason Todd because Jason Todd died while Bruce was his ward. And he's wants to investigate it, and he's going to get a subpoena to enter Bruce Wayne's facilities. And to make matters worse, when Bruce answers the door, Cassandra is there in a bathrobe, and she's like 16. And
All right.
he looks at it and he's like, oh shit. Bruce is there in his bathrobe. Cassandra's there in a bathrobe and she's a little girl. And he's like, oh, son of a bitch. It just made matters worse.
I wonder if I, that sounds familiar. I wonder if I read this issue now that you mentioned that scene. Because I read just like a random, couple random issues of that series back in the day. Anyway, sorry.
No, that's interesting. And then Day 14 was thinking of you. It's pretty much a Batgirl talking to Dick Grayson, because Dick Grayson said, I'm leaving Bloodhaven, I'm going to stick with Alfie. And at this time, Barbara and Dick are an item. So she gets off the phone with him, immediately calls her dad, just to talk to him. So even the oh at this time, Ray Palmer has kind of found a cure, but in order to get the cure, to fully help Alfred, he has to break into LexCorp because LexCorp has the antiviral. And he gets into a fight with Superman because Superman doesn't want him to inject it into Alfred because he's like, this is an experimental drug. Don't do it. Don't do it. But he does it anyway. And, they inject it, and then they pretty much blast the bat cave with the gas to inoculate the bats, so that strain of the virus will not occur. On day 18, he also sends that cure to a Bane, because you got to remember that story arc that I talked about several episodes ago, where Bane was supposedly his brother.
All right.
They formed a relationship, so he actually sends the serum to him to inoculate himself with. And then Alfred's back to normal on day tw 19. And in day 20, they open up the cave and they go in there. And it's weird because there's a Star Labs kid in there. At least he's wearing a Star Labs jacket and it looks like a little kid, but he's a little bat. He's like a bat boy. And I don't know what the hell that's going to turn into. But very interesting issue, very emotional issue. The artist is fantastic. It's got the Brian Bolland cover. Highly recommend this series. It is truly a Bat family book. It is amazing. Good stuff.
It's interesting. It would be it's interesting hearing about that. 'Cause like I said, I do think I read this, but I didn't have much context for it at the time. I think I was just sampling different DC stuff and just trying stuff out, because this—that's because that this was you said it was 2002,
2000,
or
3.
oh, okay, yeah. I mean, early 2000s. I was trying a lot of DC stuff and starting to follow certain series, but I would still pick up other stuff I was less familiar with because I was still learning a lot about the DC universe and stuff at that time.
Right.
Oh.
Everybody got a boatload of DC this week.
Yeah. Like it or
Yeah, I get into my phases and I don't know what my next phase will be, but right now I'm really into DC.
yeah. I think anybody that listens to this, they know that they're it's not always going to be DC, but there's going to be a fair amount of DC. Just like speaking of comics and history, he was apologizing for, or not apologizing, but just saying, I'm going to change things up a little bit with recent episodes and take a break from DC. And I was listening to that and thinking, well, anytime you want to return to DC, it's fine with me. So if you're listening, Brian.
Yeah, me too. I'm biased towards DC, at least the history of it. Because I can read bad DC and I still get something out of it.
And
And
there's nothing wrong with that because you're aware of it, you know?
Marvel is damn good comics, and so are the independents. I go through like these states and I read what I feel like reading. And right now I feel like reading old DC. Yeah. So yeah, this is a lot of good books covered. Now I got to go back and get the Superboy, Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah,
The
there's nothing wrong with.
covers that you covered today of the super the I really liked them. They were
The
cool
covers of the
covers.
issues. Yeah, some good ones. Some good.
They're like
Those.
action scenes.
Yeah, it was much more common back then to have that.
And the Legion of Superheroes women are just so damn sexy. They just are. Just damn.
That guy that's after Bruce Wayne's gonna be knocking on your door, Mike.
Yeah. That was like the worst thing that could happen, because he's there to he's investigating all his wards and him being delinquent with them, and then he answers the door and he's in a bathrobe, and then Cassandra comes up, who's at the door? And she's in a bathrobe, and he's like looking like, are you gonna let me in? And he's like, no, and then I'll have to get a subpoena. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, that's not good to have a 16-year-old walking around in a bathrobe.
But the other thing that was
And,
interesting is, yeah, the other thing that was interesting was Batman's relationship with the Justice League, because they were even talking about quarantining them in case Bruce had it. You know what I mean? So they were up in their satellite, and he was like, oh, I wonder if we should quarantine ourselves.
Yeah, it's nice that they don't forget, didn't forget he's a member of that team, you know?
Yeah. Scott Beatty is slowly turning into one of my favorite Batman writers, and it's because I think he's doing such a fantastic job with the family. You know what I mean? It's not all Bruce. It's Alfred. And yeah, it was just coincidence that I see Alfred in the deathbed, and on because he was injected with fear toxin in Batman Eternal, and you see him in this deathbed here, and reading them simultaneously, it kind of got me emotional, you know, because of the different circumstances. But yeah, this is good comics. I really enjoyed. Matter of fact, I've been on such a retro kick that I read a lot of Birds of Prey. I read a lot of older books this past couple weeks.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was wondering which ones of them you're actually talk about on the show, or if it was, are we gonna have like a 10-hour
Yeah,
podcast, or
I didn't talk about all of them, but
no, you can't. But
I think I summarized 16 issues of Cobalt pretty good.
you did. I was impressed that you started that off. It's like, well, I read 16 issues of Cobalt. I'm just like, should I go use the bathroom or find something to do?
Yeah, that's a lot of issues.
Yeah, that's a pretty good job.
All right. Well, you want to wrap this guy up?
Yeah, it's about that time. It actually feels like it's later than it is.
Yeah, this is for you, Daryl. Daryl was upset we didn't record. It ruined his schedule.
He's like, what's this Batman Eternal bullshit? What does
Yeah.
Chris think he's doing? He can't talk about new comics. Get back on the job, bastard. Well, we dedicate this episode to you, Daryl. Thanks for listening.
Yep.
And any of you else that are listening and would like to contact us, you could do that a few different ways. You can get us on Twitter. I'm at MythMakingETC, and Mike is Mike Myers Brunch. Or you could email us either at MythMakingETC@gmail.com or Mike@comicbooknoise.com. You could leave a comment on the website, geekbrunchpodcast.com. And we'd love if you would leave a review on iTunes.
We
You
would
can
love
find,
it.
we'll love it and love you.
Yes.
We'll remember you come Valentine's Day. Not Christmas,
And
but
thank
Valentine's Day.
you, Brian, Jim, and Donnie for the questions.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that wraps it up.
All right. Well, have a good one. Did I sound okay? I'm using the new headset. Did it sound okay?
Oh yeah, I didn't notice the difference really.
Okay, that's good. It's wireless,
So
so I can be a little more mobile.
yeah, I might have to get one of those at some point so I can do my potty without stopping. Well, without stopping and without having to unmute and have somebody hear me.
That's right. All
But
right. Well,
sounds good.
I will talk to you later.
All right,
Have a good one.
bye-bye. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah.